Ahoy, it's Nerdist Podcast number 333. I'm standing in a hotel room in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Just left Austin a couple days ago, South by Southwest, and 75 degrees in Austin, and now 34 degrees in Grand Rapids, Michigan. The sky is gray. It looks like we're crammed into the bottom of a box of cotton balls. Just these little fluffy, pillowy clouds just hanging over. There's just a ceiling of white. I don't understand cold weather. I'm not a fan of it. I lived in California too long, but enough about me. Okay, one more thing about me. When I was a kid, unrelated story. When I was a kid, I built a bonfire in our driveway because I thought that Bigfoot was going to fall out of the sky and I wanted him to land on it. I don't know how that made sense to me at the time. Did I think that the fire was going to catch him and then immediately incinerate him, or that he was somehow immune to fire and that it would just catch him? Was I trying to kill him or was I trying to save him? I feel like I've had that struggle my entire life with myself. Now you tell me something about you. You're weird. Hey, I'd like to thank Squarespace.com for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. It is the Nerdist Podcast. I am an idiot. It really is the subtext of the podcast a lot of the time. But today we're calling it the Nerdist Podcast. Squarespace.com, which if you want to start a website, if you want to start a blog, is a platform that will make that super easy. And now there is an online store component, so you can start selling stuff immediately. You could sell MP3s, products, digital stuff, hardcover books, ebooks, whatever you want. There's fast merchant accounts set up. You can accept payments right away, credit card, debit cards. And they make it super, super easy, and they have a bunch of packages set up to fit whatever financial needs you may have. And it's just an easy, easy platform to use. They really make they just basically hand you everything on a platter. Better social media integration. It's incredibly well designed. You can pick from templates. Literally any experience level you are with building websites, then they can totally take care of you. So there's a free trial right now. Go to squarespace.com/nerdist. You sign up for a free account. No credit card needed. You just build your damn website. The offer code is going to be Nerdist3, which is different than the other ones. They change it all the time, huh? You're going to get 10% off your first purchase on new accounts. That includes monthly and annual plans. And don't forget about free domain registration. So squarespace.com/Nerdist, use the offer code Nerdist3. Everything you need to create an exceptional website. Yes, I should do more radio voiceover. This episode of the podcast is Patrick Warburton, a guy that I sort of worked with years ago. We worked on a cartoon together, but we never recorded together, so I actually didn't meet him for the first time until about 6 months ago at a Thrilling Adventure Hour, and what a nice guy! So, Patrick Warburton, we found out, huge Pearl Jam fan, but all in all, a good dude, and it was fun hanging out with him. So here you go, the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 333. With Patrick Warburton. Oh my god, Bigfoot!
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Yeah, you can reserve. It's all awesome now while we're just sitting here talking about what might happen, but you don't know once it starts. And now we've started. That's it.
We're on.
That's it.
And then we
ran
out of stuff. We ran out of chit-chat.
Oh my god, we had such great chit-chat before the recording went
good
on.
Patter. No, good patter.
I'm to a screeching halt.
Shit.
Let me make sure my phone's off.
Let me ask you, is it good to start any kind of a show at a screeching halt, or is it better to...
Yeah, sure, because you can only increase momentum.
Okay.
There. Yeah. There's
the momentum that has not yet begun will increase from there.
That's really beautiful, Patrick. Yeah.
The best plans are the ones you haven't fucked up yet.
But know that you will fuck all of them up.
Yeah.
Patrick Warburton is someone that I've wanted to get on the podcast for a long time. Now you are sitting here before me in our squatted podcast studio.
Around the largest amoeba-shaped table I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, I don't really know, because this is a radio station, or it was a radio facility at some point, so I guess maybe you just got to have a lot of separation with radio between me at the control panel and you, the guest.
He's the guest.
It's magnificent. This is one of those tables that, brand new, you know somebody spent $8,000 for it. But in a garage sale, you would get $30 for it. Yeah. You'd be like, where would we put that?
Yeah, and I mean, all the holes. Can we fill up these holes here?
Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to drop like a Viking range into where the soundboard was, and we're just going to make this like our own personal hot dog counter. I'm kind of going through that right now with my house. Like the house is being, we're doing stuff to the house, and you get all these really big plans. Yeah. Like, we could do this. It'd be really awesome. And then they tell you how much everything costs. And you're like, why don't we just put a door there?
Yeah, we'll just go to IKEA. Yeah.
We'll make this the game room.
We'll make this the empty, boring room without a door.
Do you are you a homeowner?
Yes.
How long have you had your house?
I guess we've been in there for about 12 years now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we're in Ventura County.
Settled in.
Yeah, geez.
You're in Ventura County?
I've been married for 22 years now. We have we got two grown kids.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean,
how's that possible? How could a young strapping guy like yourself have two grown kids?
Yeah. 20, 18, 14, and 12. Yeah.
Wow.
Jeez.
It's awesome though. It's been great.
Because like two of them are out.
No. No, we don't want them to leave. And they don't want to leave.
Stay.
It's great. My two eldest are both in university, but they both go to universities within 10 and 20 minutes of our home, so they still live at home.
Oh, nice.
As do all of their friends. So we created that environment early on. We have, you know, we've got the ping pong and the barbecue out in the back, my man cave, which has been dubbed Club Ed because of my insane devotion and fascination and unwavering support of the greatest band in the world, Pearl Jam. That's where I go. I get drunk and go out and watch DVDs. But this is...
like Pearl Jam concert DVDs?
Yeah. After my wife
like
knows that.
Where Eddie's like climbing the rafters and stuff?
He doesn't do that anymore.
Yeah. After one martini, that's it. It's like, listen, we'd all be having a better time if we're out in the barn watching Pearl Jam DVDs.
Now, let me ask you this.
Vitology, let's go.
Is it just like regular Patrick Warburton at home and then one sip and then you're just like, even flow. And then you start climbing the walls in the kitchen.
Yeah. I leave the karaoke for others too. It's not really in my thing.
Do the kids enjoy Pearl Jam or do they see it as old people music?
No, you know what? My eldest town, he gets it. His three favorite bands in the world are Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, and Pearl Jam. And it's not because I was shoving it down his throat either, you know. these are his favorite bands. My son Shane, who's 14, you know, his is Florence and the Machine. So they're going to go in whatever, direction. You can't force anybody to love a music.
No.
Or love a style.
You're not trying hard enough.
Yeah.
It is odd, though, that... You know, like thinking about when Pearl Jam started, it was probably, you know, like Zeppelin and bands like that were 20 years old.
Right.
Like, or close to it. And it's just like, it's odd to think that, like, you know, they seemed so old at that point when, you know, all the grunge stuff started happening. But now if you think it's been the same amount of time for Pearl Jam and you're like, well, they're not old. They're just guys rocking it out.
Yeah.
They're fine.
But what's amazing is how, you know, other bands from that time have already become like legacy bands, or they just go out and, you know, they're constantly creating, they're constantly, you know, at the forefront, and they're, you know, filling major venues across the world. There are millions of obsessed Pearl Jam fans. You know, just there are millions of them, and I don't know. Do any others in this room?
It took me a long time. I liked when 10 came out. You know, I was young, and I was like, it was part of that wave,
and it was totally different too. Because you know, what was 10 like? 91 maybe?
92.
91, 92. So it was the first sort of. I didn't even know what to make of the music because I hadn't, you know, as a young college student, I hadn't really heard grunge yet. And in Los Angeles, You know, I'm sure I would have heard it if I lived in Seattle. And so all I knew was like, well, there's a couple types of music. There's a hair metal, and then there's like Belle Biv DeVoe and Tony. And then all of a sudden, this kind of like dirty rock sound. Like, what's this?
Yeah.
What kind of music is this? And they're all like high-fiving on the front, and they got flannel on.
Yeah.
It was a whole different aesthetic,
too. Well, it was so sick when that happened. I mean, it's the most integral thing to happen to rock in the last four decades. I mean, since the British invasion, what's happened to rock and roll that was is integral is that movement in Seattle. I mean, first off, the hair bands just looked silly. They killed the hair band.
Almost like in a week.
In a week, they were done, you know? Yeah. And so when you talk about the really important bands, and, you know, they were the bands that were the formative bands, you know, the Mudhoneys and all that. And then you had, you know, Alice and a Soundgarden and Nirvana and Pearl Jam.
I like Screaming Trees, too.
Yeah.
Green River.
They're all awesome, but, you know, and love them all. And they're all so important to, you know, to rock and roll. And what they did hasn't been, you know, Trump. Nobody's come close to that since then. And when you think about when that happened. But Pearl Jam, to me, and I think to many others, has always been the band that had the depth and the breadth and the pathos that those other bands didn't have. A lot of them were really just angst-ridden. You know, when you look at the work that Eddie's done, his solo efforts and all the writing and what that band has done over the last two decades, it's amazing. And, you know, I've seen him probably 20 times live, which is nothing. I mean, I know the folks that have been out there and seen him 300 times live. I could argue that a lot of them haven't seen as many Pearl Jam DVDs and got drunk to them as I
have. Not as many of them are dads.
I have a family. I'm 22 years married with four kids. I can't travel and follow them all over the world, but I have friends that do now. I have friends that really didn't know much about the band, you know, 10 years ago and have now seen 200 shows.
Wow, so they came in way later than...
Yeah.
Yeah. Because that's the thing. As like, you know, like I like 10, and then like I just kind of, as I got into more like punk stuff, I was like, oh, that's just like, you know, it's not my scene. And then as I kind of got older and, you know, and started going back and listening to the other albums after 10, I was like, oh, what was I doing?
Yeah.
You know, like I was like, this is stuff that's been great the whole time.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah. Yeah, because it was such... The commercial success was so huge early on, and then, you know, but everything that they've done since then is there's just gems all throughout. You know?
Yeah,
I mean,
have you gotten to hang out with them?
There's really, I have a few times. You know, I've gotten to meet Eddie a number of times. He's always been very, very, you know, kind, and he's just a sweet guy. He let me write a set list. Let me help.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That must have been crazy.
Now, do you have a copy of that show so you can be like, I did that?
Yeah.
Oh, did
they?
Was that one of the shows they released?
It was, yeah.
And do you have all of those?
Yeah. I have a lot of them, but this was the 99 October 7th show at the Gibson. It was the third or fourth. I was there every three of the four nights. We were working one of the nights, so I missed it, but... Yeah, there were about 200 people backstage. I didn't think I'd get a chance to, you know, like say hi. I'm with my wife and some friends, and this guy Smitty with the band came up and said, "Hey, Eddie wants to know if you'll help him out with the set list."
Jeez.
What?
Yeah, after I picked my jaw up off the ground and went. I'm one of those. When I met him like for the fourth or fifth time at a special Paramount event, I almost called him Mr. Vetter. You never figure that they might actually know who you are, your name. You just,
sure.
This is who this is who you stalk. This is who you idolize. And I just wanted to let him know how special it was to be there. And he looked at me like I was a damn fool. He goes, "Patrick," and he gives me a hug. And my wife's there, and she could see the look in my eyes. I just get stupid around that guy. I get absolutely.
Do you know you're from Seinfeld?
I'm not sure, maybe that or the tick. I think he might have been a fan of
which was awesome, by the way.
That was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he gave me his email to send a set list to. Now, it's been 2 years. I don't send him emails. I can't, because all I do is get gushy and stupid.
Sure.
Gross. I just can't. You can't give your stalker your email. Yeah. So I have to be cognizant about that and recognize that that's not why I have this, so you don't use it.
It's written in a glass case in an envelope.
Yeah.
So which you have, which has two keys that have to be turned at the exact same time.
I have a buddy who's a grip, and he snuck in with me backstage when that night, and I know that he spied when Eddie was giving me his email. And I go, "I know you looked."
I know you know what it is. I swear to God, if you ever use it, he didn't give it to you. He gave it to me. You're gonna make me look like an idiot.
You just got your hand on his throat. He's like, Patrick, please, you're hurting me.
Don't ruin this for me.
But so what do you think? Well, where do you fall on the Nirvana side? Is that
I love Nirvana.
Okay, good. So you don't see Pearl Jam versus Nirvana versus.
I don't see them, any of them.
I think that was just a magazine.
Everybody has their, you know, better Pearl Jam. That's just been my muse, and that's everybody. It's different. I would argue to me they're the great band. You know, the greatest band. Everybody's got their own favorites. So, I mean, if somebody wanted to debate it, I could.
Why did they reject everything? Pearl Jam. There was that point where they were like, we're not making videos anymore. We're not doing this anymore. We don't. It was almost like they got successful and then said, we don't want to be successful anymore.
Punk rock guilt.
Was that it?
No, I think every artist in that realm, they're going to have to, you have to make choices, and certain things work for you and certain things don't. But it seems that they've always been really in touch with, like the plight of the everyday, man, I mean, that's why Ticketmaster just really, rubbed them the wrong way. And they became, their whole program as far as producing and making all of their art and music available to the world has really been you could look at it from a marketing standpoint and say, wow, this is quite perfect. They bootleg their own albums and then they get them out there. And there is no middleman, So they make those, affordable. They're really well produced. I think it's a great idea. I think they should bootleg, the live footage from all of their shows.
Sure.
You go, they could probably, that would entail some more work, but.
Yeah, I always, I guess, they start out like as any artist does, like we just want to play music, we just want to do this thing, and then they start getting more successful, and why would they not do that?
Yeah.
But then at a certain point, it somehow seems to get too top heavy, and then it seems that they
Well, they probably saw it start happening to a lot of their friends, so many of their friends' bands were huge too, and they saw a lot of the stuff that kind of maybe they didn't like, or they like. It was like, we got to be careful about this. This happening to us.
I bet a lot of it probably also has to do with the commercialization of everything and the sort of label of, because I'm sure when they were first playing music, they probably didn't go, let's play grunge music. They just said, let's just sort of play this music that we want to play.
Well, their band before that, Mother Love Bone, was kind of a glammy band.
Well, do you think then it was I wonder how much of it was a sort of this is what the market wants versus this is just what we want to do.
Who knows what the hell grunge means in the movie, because they were wearing, because of the shirts they were wearing.
Yeah,
rock and roll. Like, they still laugh. It's just, it's ridiculous.
But it's funny to me that grunge sort of got to a certain point the same as like hair metal did, where it's like, okay, no, you guys are wearing costumes. It's just, they're just different, like grunge had a different aesthetic, but ultimately it got to a certain point where it's like, when your parents know what grunge is. Yeah, you're wearing one of those grunge shirts, and all of a sudden it's sort of, and I assume they are probably like, fuck, we don't want to be a part of that. And much in the same way that when alternative comedy became a thing called alternative comedy, a lot of the original comics who made it happen were like, I fucking hate that term.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
I think that when you look at it, the music that came out of that region, I would rather take the long way of saying, instead of calling it grunge, is going to stand the test of time, as opposed to so much of the hair bands of the 80s. When you listen to it, it's a lot of that is can be ridiculous. There's a lot of those great, but a lot of it's also ridiculous.
Sure,
but
yeah.
All that music just stands up. It stands up today like it did, back in 1991.
What do you think is the best? If someone was a Pearl Jam fan in the 90s and then sort of fell off, like what's a good re-entry point? Is it Eddie's solo work, like the Into the Wild soundtrack, or what do you think is?
Well, yeah, any of that. I mean, there are those that's still as perfect as his ukulele, CD is, there are those that just might not be able to listen to ukulele. But it's
a good album,
it's magnificent.
Yeah,
it really
great.
Is, like the Into the Wild soundtrack where that's something you could spin 1,000 times and never get old. But I mean, I would feel like you could just dive in anywhere. But if you've never been to a show, you know, you got to get to a show because those are life changing experiences. The first Pearl Jam show I went to was the Traffic and Transportation Building at the State Fairgrounds in Oklahoma. I was out there doing a movie with Peter Berg back when he was doing more acting than directing. And
yeah.
He was the one who knew they were there. He mentioned it, and I said, "Yeah, sure, let's go." I was already a fan, but. Just it was the best rock show I've ever been to, and
that's what happened to my friend. He was never into Pearl Jam. Yeah. He got a free ticket because he was working at a Subway sandwich place right where the next to the venue they were playing. Mm-hmm. And he gave a free sandwich to one of the bouncers. He's like, "Hey, Pearl Jam is playing tonight. If you want to come by for free," he's like, "Whatever. I got nothing to do." And then from there on out, he became my Pearl Jam friend. Like this guy, like shirts, fucking got everything. Like just became obsessed. Like his like screen name on Instant Messenger was like, you know, a Pearl Jam reference.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, I got 60, 70 t-shirts now, as is my buddy Torque, who's the grip I told you about brought there, you know. And you spot him, you know, you're like, oh, the brotherhood. Danny Masterson is a sick Pearl Jam fan. And We bonded a lot over that, you know, we'll be, you know, in a golf tournament somewhere playing and have a few drinks at night. And we just talk about the band. We just get into the band.
That's great. Do you play an instrument?
I don't. I'm 48 years old. I really literally just started taking singing lessons.
Oh, fun.
That's awesome.
It's just good therapy. You know, I don't know if I don't think anything will ever come of it other than maybe I might be able to sell something, a silly, you know, musical at some point.
Sure.
But it's just good training. It's great therapy. I could talk about Pearl Jam for hours, you know, but what we started talking about was the environment at home, why the kids are all there. And I want to finish up with that.
Sure.
We got the house. We got a game room upstairs, and then, you know, we got the pool. And out in Ventura County, everybody's on like 2 acres. I found the best way to buy like an estate without paying an estate price mm-hmm. is to buy an equestrian area and don't have horses.
Oh,
you know? That's really smart.
Yeah, it's like, okay, this house is huge. It's on like 2 park-like acres. And it doesn't cost that much because it's just, everybody's house is out there, yeah. And you know, so we've got all this room, and we always wanted to keep the kids around, so we did create an environment where all their buddies, you know, find our place to be sort of the home away from home. So Sunday nights we'll have anywhere between 12 and 15 teenagers, you know, dressed like zombies watching The Walking Dead, you know. Monday night, they'll all be there for another reason. You know, it could be like a Tuesday night, and, you know, one of Talon's buddies will be out there barbecuing burgers, and they're all around. And I'll look at my wife, and I'll be like, is it Saturday? She's like, no, it's Tuesday. I go, it is. It's like any normal Tuesday at our house.
You're going to have to start going to further and further lengths as the kids get older. It's like, hey, kids, we open a bar up over where the barn would be.
Yep.
We got a bar. We got some bands coming in. Yeah. Dad's got a jam with Eddie.
Water park in the corner.
Yeah. We got an arcade. Huh? You kids like arcades.
We gotta raise the stakes. Yeah.
What are your kids? Do they know what they want to do yet? Do they want to go into performing or not performing, or do they not care about it?
I think my little guy Gabriel might want to go into the biz. He's just an amazing little kid. He plays the guitar. They all play the guitar now. That's just something I wish that I'd learned to do early on. And so I got this guy who comes up to the house and just works with all of them on a Sunday. So he'll be out for about 2-3 hours, and he'll just spend 40 minutes with each one of them. And so they're all doing great.
It's not too late for you to learn the guitar if you wanted to.
I got a ukulele. My buddy Tor gave me a ukulele, you know, and... it's a little easier to pick up. It's 4 strings. And you just have some fun with it.
My dog has fleas.
Patrick Warburton's Uke Jam. You just cover all the Pearl Jam songs Uke style.
I play Gilligan's Island, the Ballad of Gilligan's Island. Awesome.
But you could just sing the lyrics of Jeremy to Gilligan's Island. Jeremy spoke in class today.
I keep going.
On an uncharted desert isle with Stone Gossard, Jeff Ament, Mike McCready, and their wives,
and the rest.
See, there you go. There is a million view video right there. Patrick Warburton singing a Pearl Jam lyrics to singing lyrics of Pearl Jam to the Gilligan's Island theme. Done.
Or maybe a disappointing 161 views.
Yeah. It's possible. You never know with YouTube.
32 likes and 14 dislikes.
Oh, those dislikes.
Damn.
You know, for 161 views, that's a lot of votes, though. We're going to find a positive way to spin this.
This isn't anything. The retention value of those 161. I hosted the Streamies last weekend, and I talked about this. When you watch... The most popular Russian Meteor video had like 32,000 likes and like 2,054 dislikes. Who thumbs downs this really awesome Meteor footage? You're like, yeah. Nope. Scary. Nope.
Well, the production value wasn't stunning. Yeah. Most the guy was driving and filming with his iPhone 1, right? It's Russia.
Probably.
So,
yeah.
Do they even have the iPhone?
No, they just have dashboard cams.
Mm. Yeah, so a lot of them had dashboard cams, and they caught on
Russia. So
maybe that was it. I don't know, but I don't know why. That just doesn't really seem like something to editorialize over. Nope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Only like terrestrial disasters.
Most people just hate everything.
They really do, Patrick. They really do. Do you enjoy? Do you enjoy where our culture has gone from there? Because, you know, just taking it back to Pearl Jam for a second, that era of music was really kind of the last great era of kind of a unified music business before it all just started to crumble. You know, that took us into like 95, 96. All of a sudden, you know, people have internet. And then it just all blah, 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 blah. And then, you know, audiences are splintered. People are kind of getting their niche needs met. People aren't coming together to listen to.
But it's still, I mean, if you're a musician out there, the only money to be made is making live music anymore. And, you know, arguably, I mean, that makes, I think what a band like Pearl Jam does, you know, all the more. They've got a perfect system because they do the best live show in the world. So
they were grandfathered in, though. They're a famous. Yeah. They're already a band that people liked.
This is true. So it's difficult. Yeah, it is difficult to get to that point in this day and age because it's just the market is saturated.
Yeah. I wonder how they decide. I wonder when you're a band who has that many albums and that many songs. There are always going to be songs where people are like, how come they didn't play? You know, even when they might, how many songs do they play in a typical show?
They have a catalog of, you know, 1,000 songs.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, I still hear things. I'm like, I'm not sure I've ever heard that one before, you know, and it's just awesome. But I had a good set list. You know, it's cool when Eddie's on stage and he says, well, this last song, you know, maybe we played it once in a city, but we've never played it here. And then he goes into Crown of Thorns and I'm like, yes. He played alone and a lot of great stuff. It was a great night. I didn't open with Long Road, which is an awesome tune. It would have been a great one to open with. So they opened with Long Road that night, and I wasn't sure that they're gonna, but out of like the 34 songs, 28 of them ended up being my.
Wow.
Oh, shit.
Were you doing a lot of deep cuts to kind of impress Eddie? Like, it's like he's going to love the fact that
those,
I wanted
to play it. Yeah, you want it to be well-rounded. So there were deep ones. Yeah, but I had, like Black and Yellow Ledbetter, which, you know, didn't make the final cut. But they were on and they played them another night. You know,
I like that Eddie Vedder really was like your personal MP3 player for a minute. Or and then I'll play this one. Yeah. I'll create this playlist.
Man. Oh, just here's my iPod playlist. You could just.
But instead of listening to the iPod, you're controlling Eddie Vedder.
Yeah.
My obsessions have just gotten, you know, have just, I think, just gotten better or cooler throughout the years. But early on, they were, you know, when I was a freshman in high school, I weighed 95 pounds and I had these glasses here go on over my contacts. I'm blind as a bat.
Wow.
I usually win in the my eyesight's worse than your eyesight contest. Unless you have a red tipped cane.
And then that's it's you.
LASIK?
I'm not a candidate for laser surgery.
Oh.
Yeah. They're not good. But I used to collect stamps and coins and I could tell you all about stamps. I would go, there'd be a bid board. And so if there was say there's like a Buffalo nickel, and you know, this was like eBay, you know, 35 years ago. This is like 13th time. And so, I take my book out. Well, this Buffalo nickel, 1915 Buffalo nickel, is valued in this condition at 23 cents. The last bid on it is at 12 cents.
You're going to make a killing.
I'm going to go, I don't want him to come back. I'm just going to go straight to 14 cents. So I get this nickel and I come home. Dad. So I get this Buffalo nickel for 14 cents. Look, it's worth 22 cents. Well, son, something's really only worth as much as somebody's going to pay for it. Thanks a lot, Dad. Thanks for taking the wind out of my sails.
I had the coin collection, too. I had the books with all of the, you know, like where they were minted and what year. And then, you know, every once in a while, you and maybe this is, you know, in your kid mind, you're like, well, I think this does fit the criteria for this coin, which could be worth thousands of dollars. Yeah. And then you take it somewhere and they're like, no, because, also has your thumbprint on it. And,
you know? Yeah. So, did you keep it in your pocket on the way over here? Yeah. Yes.
If you hadn't gotten your finger oils on it,
yeah,
it
would
be worth a lot more.
You almost didn't ruin it. So that's a good, you know, that's something to think about.
Remember that when you're going home to your poorhouse.
Yeah, but, I had all of the, you know, the Buffalo nickels and the wheat pennies and the Liberty quarters and all that great stuff. I remember those.
And the comic books I collected were not the cool ones, not Batman, not the dark ones. Those are too dark. And the ones I had were the Richie Rich. These are probably like the Donald Duck. I had every. They were all feel gooders.
Yep. You know?
I didn't want to have nightmares. But
I would love to see Chris Nolan's Richie Rich. I think that actually might.
That is Batman.
That is Batman. Yeah. That's what happens. Damn it! That's not fair.
Sorry. I got the point, Chris.
Chris Nolan's Richie Rich is just the Dark Knight. So when did those obsessions kind of wane? When did you decide, I think maybe I shall be a performer? I think maybe I'm not going to be 95 pounds anymore.
Boy, I don't know. Rocky had something to do with that. The movie Rocky.
Wow.
Yeah, I was about 12 or 13, and the next day I was drinking raw eggs and like dressing like Rocky. I'd even like throw the towel over the neck and then stuff it in a sweatshirt.
While reading a Donald Duck comic book. This is an intense adventure he's having with Huey, Dewey, and Louie.
How's he going to get those nephews to bed?
But unfortunately, I started growing. But no, I was so tiny. I used to get bullied a bit, you know. I mean, I remember like. I was a kid, you know, who'd walk home from the bus stop after taking the bus for an hour to go to an all-boys college prep school where they could recruit football players, too. So it was either academics or football. And, like, I did not fit in. And then, you know, then I'd get off that bus after an hour drive home from school. And, you know, I remember the two guys that would sit out there and just, like, spit on me when I'd walk home.
Oh, no.
Jeez.
It was just horrible.
Where did you grow up?
In Huntington Beach.
Oh, okay. Oh.
Yeah. It was just horrible. But and then I started growing, so it was good. The worst talk show experience I've ever had, I was actually up in the Seattle area for the Seattle Film Festival. And so I was in a film where I did play a bully. It's so funny. I hate bullies. I grew up hating bullies, and I play bullies all the time. So in this one movie, I played a bit of an ass, and a real asshole. And so I get a call from my publicist. They said, you want to do a show called, I think it's called Northwest Today. And it's, you know, it's on one of the, you know, major networks. I think it's like on NBC or something, but all throughout the Pacific Northwest. It's a live show. They have a male and a female host. They have an audience. And, this will be great. I can get on there and promote the movie, get people coming to see the movie. And they're going to do the shows on bullying. You know, do you have any stories like when you were a kid about being bullied? And I don't tell them the horrible story about getting spit on. Oh, sure. I'm thinking this will all be, you know, fun and games. You know, I didn't realize how heavy it was going to get. Yeah, I was bullied. I wasn't bullied any more than, you know, I don't think I was probably bullied any more than the next kid. But I got some stories. So I go now. I think that's the host. I think she's, you know, she's gunning for an Emmy here because I have been had. I am standing backstage with a coffee in my hand and I'm watching a monitor. And there's a woman on stage whose child killed themselves because they had been bullied.
Uh-huh.
There are audience members in tears. They're in tears on stage. I'm holding this cup of coffee. I'm like, what did I get myself into? The host of the show looks at the camera right after this woman's, you know, talked about losing a child. We have to go to break. When we come back, a former cast member of Seinfeld who was tortured by bullies.
Oh, no.
The coffee drops out of my head. And the thing was, it's like, I couldn't have, like, if I were to block this in a movie, he drops the cup of coffee out of his hand. The coffee drops. It's on the floor. Oh, my God. And then you go out there and you can't be a dick. You can't go out there and go, listen, I didn't sign up for this. Yeah. You just gotta give them what you can.
You bully them. No, yeah, you turn the show around right now. I'm going to beat the shit out of you.
No, you want to help these people, you know? And so all of a sudden I came out there, and for the next 20 or 30 minutes, I just talked about what people need to do. And, you know, I become a professional.
Well, that's you're nice.
This is what you all got to do. No, I ended up bragging on my kids, you know? I go, my son, Talon, he would intervene. It's not enough to, you know, to just, you know, stay away or not bully, you know, it's a numbers thing, you know. So you got to get, you know, the rest of the gang at school and say, we don't tolerate this stuff. You can't stand idly by when other people mm-hmm. get bullied. And I just went in that direction. But that was...
Sounds like it actually went okay.
That was fine.
That's not where I thought you were going with this. I thought you were going this way, like, coming up next, a man who revels in playing bullies in film. Like, I thought it was going to be...
Why do you glorify?
Yeah. How dare you, sir?
No, I hate him. I did a movie that my kids have never seen. It's called Joe Somebody. A lot of people have never seen it. but I smacked the crap out of Tim Allen in front of his 10-year-old child. And it's so ugly that I, from the very beginning, I just go, don't ever watch this movie. So, I don't know if any of them ever even wanted to, but I just, and none of them have ever seen it. Because to me, there's a lot they could see. They could see, you know, dad with a gun at war. I don't know, whatever. But not hitting a man in front of his child. I think that's the ugliest thing. And although they know that it's just a movie, it's just an image I never wanted them to
see. I think we'll all agree it's tough to keep kids away from those Tim Allen films. So I'm surprised that actually, I'm sure they've actually seen it 100 times.
Yeah, well, no, I'm sure there's a DVD of it floating around the house. I'm like, eh, don't watch
it. Come on. Dad says don't watch
it. I'm just going to leave this right here. Don't watch it.
But where did when did the performing stuff start, and when did you realize, like, you could play that guy?
I don't know. I just remember, like, in third and fourth grade, you know, playing free speech and, you know, like, some Thanksgiving show at school and just being really dorky and, you know, I had fun with it. And then I, like, remember taking a leak in the bathroom, and one of the big guys, one of the, like, who would have been huge, one of the bullies, you know, like standing next to me at the urinal next to me. That was funny, man. And the first like acceptance I ever got was like, am I going to get a swooshy? Is someone going to stick my head in the toilet? I was very nervous. He's like, yeah, that was funny. And I just thought, damn, this is my in.
That's my way in. Yeah.
This is my in.
This is how I will control them.
Make them laugh.
But I didn't do anything really until college didn't work out. Then I thought, try this acting.
The Tick was such a fun show, and a show that I think I would love for it still to be on.
Yeah. Well, when you got Barry Sonnenfeld, you know, producing it, you got Larry Charles as your runner, and Ben Edlund's great creation.
Such a stacked show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess it was just too expensive, you know, for the network. That's why, you know, like Murdoch and company, they just looked at it, and it was a half-hour show that cost as much as most one-hour shows
mm-hmm.
because they weren't doing single-camera half-hours at a time. As well, you know, one of the early ones. Mm. Oh, this show costs a lot because we're shooting 10 hours a day, and it's costume-intensive. And there's a show called Joe Millionaire.
Yes.
And one of their first reality shows, and it got huge viewership, and they're businessmen at the network. They just looked at it and said, look, this is an hour long. It's shot on video. We don't pay any actors. It's cheap, and look at the numbers we get. I'm not going to support, you know, a show that costs as much. And so, in the long run, you know, they're the losers for not doing that. But, I mean, to think that we only did 9 or 10 episodes and that they turned out like that, I mean, if that show had evolved, it would have been, you know, more than that. But, and there will be, you know, the Tick is a great, he's the whole inception of this character is ingenious, and somebody else will get to step into those shoes at some point and have fun, you know.
I hope so. I still think you could. I think you could still do it if you wanted to. We should just start making them.
Yeah. I always thought there was. I was always kind of hoping there would be a movie to come out and just like see the live action Tick on a large scale.
Yeah.
You know, it would have been so fun to see.
Yeah. Well, one of these days.
Why not today, Patrick?
If somebody out there might start a letter writing campaign.
Soundtrack by Eddie Vedder. Yeah. That'd be fucking rad.
He'd do it.
Of course he would do it.
Yeah.
What have you, we worked on, well, we actually never worked together, but we both did The X's, which is a cartoon at Nickelodeon that our friend Carlos Ramos created and directed. And so I played Glowface.
You were Glowface.
I was. And so, which is a weird sound, I played Glowface, which was basically my bad attempt at doing a Wallace Shawn impression. So the whole thing with everything is like this, and which was a total mistake because it shredded my voice. Like I got the job, and they were like, "Okay, great, now you have to do that every week," and it was just all shouting. But you guys were great, and Wendy Malick was on the show, and Stephen Root, and like it was a fucking awesome cast.
Yeah, I remember Carlos was obsessed with just trying to get like all the people he's ever wanted to work with. Like he was just like he's like always trying to get people.
But we never got to record together because they recorded all of us individually. So you would never even see anyone else.
The art on that show was kind of cool. It was sort of retro.
Yeah.
Like no black lines. I think that was like right. It was just like color on color. There was never any like outlines with that. Yeah.
It was a really fun. It was a really fun show.
Yeah,
which.
Funky.
Yeah, I always thought that hopefully one day you guys would make a live action full length movie that thing.
Of the X's?
Just everything that gets canceled. I just always thought it'd be really cool.
To see a movie. That's Jonah's go-to.
No.
Really wish I just wanted to see that as a movie. Are you doing a lot of voiceover stuff now?
Yeah. Working on another Disney movie and then working on Family Guy.
Of course, yeah.
Scooby-Doo is working on that still.
I did a couple episodes of that.
Yeah.
I got to be the villain that says I would have gotten away with it if it hadn't been for you meddling kids. And it was one of the fucking greatest things that I ever got to to do.
You're getting to deliver those iconic lines. Be that. Yeah. That's cool.
I finally got to.
With voiceover, do you just do it from home? Do you have like a recording?
No, I still don't have that set up and I need it. But I find that most of the projects I work on, they want you in there anyways.
They want all the people there for notes and so.
Well, they don't want them all there together, but they do want them in there. Yeah. So.
Well, Family Guy's just right across the plaza from here.
I will be going there immediately after here.
Oh, nice.
You know, I live an oil change away. So, see, yeah.
Together. Did you
like 5 hours to kill?
I was supposed to go in there tomorrow, and I said, if you could squeeze me today, that would do.
I'm going to be right across the building.
Yeah.
I mean, it's literally 30 steps away, is their offices.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're going to validate my parking and everything.
Yeah. You know what?
I am so good.
I'll tell you what. We'll just validate your parking for the whole day.
Whoa, okay. Chris.
And then you can go building to building. Shut up, Joan. I know what I'm doing.
We talk about this the entire day.
We do not have a budget for that.
Or at all.
Writing checks, your body can't.
That's right. I have to fight the parking people at the end of the day. Yeah. And if I win, then I don't have to pay any parking. And if they win, then I have to pay all the parking, which is horribly expensive. Mm. Oh, look, it's our soup friend. Hey, guys. Did you never want to do... Did you never try...
Manny Patinkin.
He does look like Manny Patinkin. Did you never want to do stand-up or anything?
I did stand-up for a minute when I was 20 years old. It's the one thing I regret quitting.
Oh, I thought you were going to regret it.
No, it was fun. It was cool. And it was a trip because when I was 20, I mean, Sam Kennison, I saw a lot of stuff back there. It was just the lines of blow everywhere from the kitchen to backstage at the Comedy Store. I remember, talking to Sam about the sacrilegious stuff, bringing that up, and I don't remember. I think he told me to. Is this rated? What is this rated?
It's rated. Say whatever the fuck you want.
Okay.
Yeah, it's rated XXX. We'll show penetration.
NC-17. Sam said, "Go fuck yourself." But which I deserved as a 20-year-old kid, you know, like, Sam, the sacrilegious stuff.
were you sincerely kind of hounding him about it?
Yeah. I grew up in a very. I told you I went to Catholic schools growing up, and
I did too. All boys Catholic high school.
Same here.
Sam, you're really funny. When you do all that yelling stuff, it's really funny. But the sacrilegious.
I love it.
I think you need to go to
20-year-old kid telling Sam Kinison.
It's like I turned into my mother.
I mean, you know, it's fine. Then move to where the food is, bit. That's really funny.
Fuck yourself.
And then went back to a line of blow on a
on
some centerfold's vagina.
But the most. One thing I early on, I just the dysfunction, seriously, of the comics at the time. Everybody was so fucked up back there, you know. I just thought it was sort of, it's comics take a lot of that and turn it around and find, it's important to find the humor and situations in life, but it was an environment that was kind of trippy to me. It's a great thing to have, you know.
I'm telling you, it must have, you know, when I think about the mind of a comic, and just how unstable it can be. And then you like, I feel like now we sort of have the gift of people are into therapy and they know we're aware of anxiety and we talk about these things and, you know, we're anti-drug. And I mean, I'm not saying everyone, but then back then it's just like 70s and 80s was like, it's on. You're just fucking doing everything and it's completely accepted. Like, I'm surprised everyone didn't die.
No, I am too, because that's what was expected of you back then, you know. And it was everybody was, you know, doing drugs, and you know, unless you're like Louis Anderson, then you were having a sandwich. But everybody had their addiction, you know.
He was snorting sandwiches.
Yeah,
and then of course all of the coke from the hair metal days evolved to the heroin of the grunge scene.
Yeah,
it just even the drugs like change. It's so funny how. Yeah. When the movement, like the whole movement is different and literally every facet is almost seems to be designed like, well, we're not going to be that, so we're going to do this. I know it wasn't necessarily a conscious decision, but it is interesting to see the evolution because Sam was part of that kind of hair metal community on the comic side.
Yeah. Yeah, he was a rock star, you know.
And then even you even saw comedy go through the same thing with the previously mentioned alternative comedy movement was essentially the kind of grunge movement of comedy from like the big arena style stand-ups, the Dice Clays and the Kinisons to like, we're in a coffee house. I'm reading out of my notebook. There's no flash. It's very pared down, you know, it's a pure, you know.
Even before that, like, you know, just the comics I would perform with Sinatra. Everyone, like, you know, they're all hanging out with these, like, classy, and, like, comics wore suits, and everyone was real classy, and, you know, bup. So it's always kind of mirrors it.
I don't know how to define what the cultural movement of 2013 is, or I don't know what the cultural movement now is. I feel like it was easier to identify then, or maybe it's easier in retrospect, but if you said, like, what's pop music now, or what's pop anything, I'm not 100% sure I would know like what rock and roll is or what. I don't know. Is there rock and roll still?
Black Keys?
Yeah.
As far as like pop music, rock and roll, like the like popular rock and roll, like Black Keys are still really big.
Yeah, and then it's like an evolution, and and they're really cool. I thought that was my favorite Grammy performance is when they with the Preservation Hall band. That was
really good. I like that Mumford & Sons performance too.
Yeah,
I like that he just has that bass drum there.
Yeah,
like the guitar player. What I did not enjoy was the musical performance from the band Fun. And I did not like that.
You're not a fan.
Was Frank Ocean a little out of key? That was weird.
It did sound a bit weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, it didn't sound like the album.
I didn't see the Grammys.
That album's great.
It didn't sound good.
We have I work Sunday nights, and so our first Talking Dead Bat was Grammy night. So I didn't see any. I don't know if I even would have watched the Grammys if I were home, but What was the fun band?
Well, you know, they're playing their song that sounds like it's from Newsies, and then they just had rain start to fall on them, which looks cool, but then like my reaction was like, they're gonna get electrocuted. Oh, they're not actually playing. Oh, that's not a real fun performance at all.
Well, that's why it's a period after fun.
Yeah, exactly. If it was an exclamation point, I'd probably like them a lot more.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. It's strange. Listen, the last decade shortly more so, we've changed as a people and a society the way we socially interact. That's all changed because of all the new media and whatnot. And I, I still, you know, I'm trying to catch up. I have to ask my kids how to work shit. And I feel like an old man, you know.
There's just too much.
There is. It's just too much. You can access it.
I guarantee you that there's stuff that they don't know about. There's just too much of everything available at all times now to be able.
They're really smart kids.
You would have to not. You would have to not do anything else other than just consume.
Yeah.
To be able to be up to speed on everything, you wouldn't be able to have a job. You wouldn't be able, if you caught up on every video game, every book, every movie, every television show, every internet thing. There's no, that's a fucking job. That's a full-time, 80-hour-a-week job just trying to do that.
I don't know, yeah. There's got to be a machine that can do what I do. Listen, I'm not even as a voiceover artist. I don't even have that kind of range. I'm not exactly a chameleon. I might do different characters, but they all sound a little. I don't know how much longer I can make this work.
Oh, I worked with on a show once, on a voiceover show once, and there was an actor, and he was fucking great at doing it. Like, he just had his voice, and it always kind of hurt his feelings when he was like, "Can I do one of the other ones?" And they'd be like, "Okay, you know, try this character," and then it'd be like, "Rrr, it'd be the same voice." But in his mind, he would think it was different, and they were I don't know.
Which is like so many cartoons from the like 70s and 80s, all those movies. Just it's like, and Dom DeLuise as a cat version of Dom DeLuise.
But then, you know, you have these voiceover guys like Rob Paulsen or Jeff Bennett or Dee Baker who just fucking come in and they're almost impossible to spot in a show because they're so versatile with their voices. And it's pretty, like, when you see a really good, I think voiceover work is harder because it's all based on your performance.
Yeah. But you can goof and experiment with that too, you know, and have fun with it. And if it doesn't work, you just try something else. And so you really do have room to sort of explore, you know, whereas I'm not sure you have that when you're doing on camera stuff. It's like, what the fuck did he just do?
Yeah.
Oh, let's tone it down a little bit. Yeah. You don't know how it's too far until we get there.
Hey, guys, I really thought I would do it like this now. Yeah, like, right. Why is he doing that?
Yeah, going back to one is easier in animation.
Much easier.
But in voiceover, you can do that, yeah.
Do you actually, does Seth sit in on the recordings or does someone?
Well, he did for years. He directed everything for years up until he became.
Do you think hosting the Oscars is going to take up a lot of his time?
Can't even talk to the guy anymore. He's disappeared. He's the guy behind the curtain now.
Yeah, sure. I'm sure.
I mean, I remember like 5 or 6 years ago, he'd ask me questions, you know, about stuff I was doing. Like, he was actually curious or interested.
Yeah.
Like, he could give a fuck now. Patrick, let me tell you what it was like hosting the Academy Awards. I mean, here's the difference. This is the difference between Seth and me now. He's hosting the Academy Awards. I'll be going to a viewing party. I've never even been. He's hosting. And my wife's such a snob, you know, because I'm going to, you know, she's like, there's this party that this old Hollywood guy, Norby Walters, has. And it's really cool. You know, it's fun, you know. But, I mean, he has like 15, 20 people who have actually won won Academy Awards. And they go. But my wife's right. She's like, oh, you're going to go watch the awards with everybody else who wasn't invited.
Oh, you know,
she's like, it's so cheesy. I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, it doesn't sound very cool now. Like, listen, hon, I get what you're saying, bitch. But listen, I'm going to, I go, by the way, because like last year's your first year, I finally went to this thing because I was like, I just want to, go have a little bit of fun. So I go out and, I mean, and like my, Bryan Cranston is a buddy of mine. He's sitting next to me. So I go home and I'm like, honey, by the way, snobby lady. Cranston was there. This guy's won like 9 Emmys. You
he
know,
could go to the Academy Awards.
For his britches. He's probably going to be there this year, I would think. You know,
because of Drive, right? No, Drive was the year before.
Argo.
Yeah.
You know, so whatever. But I want to, you know, I want to go out and have some fun this year.
But Cranston's a guy who I could see him. Even if he got an invitation to the Academy Awards, he seems like the kind of to be like, I'd rather just go watch it with my friends.
Right.
Yeah,
sure. Yeah, he's super down to earth. Super down to earth, dude. He's really cool.
I'd like to see just I'm Cranston driving across country solving crimes, like Supernatural style. I'd love to see you and Cranston in Supernatural. Just recast you guys as the movie version of Supernatural. You guys driving across country, slaying demons.
I'll tell you what, done, because I can make decisions. Like, I can get the ball rolling. I can green light that right now. I have a little production company. I'm excited though for the awards this year for the first time ever. Because it'll be fun to watch what Seth does. I think he'll be a really good fit. He's a great combination of old school and new school.
He's a song and dance man.
He's a song and dance.
But hosting the Oscars is a no-win situation. There isn't any. Every year,
tell that to Billy Crystal, you son of a bitch.
but every year, no matter who hosts it. They're always like, the press is always like, it's the worst year ever. I don't know what fucking happened. Seth, the thing I feel bad for Seth is that he even got slammed a couple times just doing pre-stuff because they're like, he's not taking it seriously. Like, don't fuck yourself. It should be funny. And, but Seth's going to ride that line because that's Seth. He's going to offend people in some way. And then that's going to be like, how could he? Take this precious gem.
Yeah, but then he'll sing like an old classic song, and all the old people go, "Oh, what a nice boy."
Can you imagine? Like, I remember seeing Seth at. We talked about this when Ron Perlman was on, but there was one night I used to go to karaoke all the time, and there was one night at the Brass Monkey where Ron Perlman and Seth were basically having an unofficial karaoke off, because Ron's a big karaoke guy and Seth's a big karaoke guy, and they both like Sinatra. So there was this sort of a weird, knowing what this means to Seth, getting to sing an old timey song at the fucking Academy Awards.
Oh yeah.
How do you go up from there? I think it's just suicide, right, guys?
That's exactly what
I think. It's just it. I mean, you walk off stage and then you hang yourself.
Yeah, he's gonna have a blast, and it'll be really cool for, I think, just a large, a large portion of the country that just really doesn't know him or see him, like my parents who just hate his guts for his show, to see him in this light will be interesting. My mother's one of the ones who's been trying to get that show off the air for years.
Oh, wow.
Really?
Yeah, I formal signed complaints to the FCC to get Family Guy off the air from my mother. She's left tearful messages on my phone.
Oh,
she does. She believes my soul's in peril for being on it.
Do you buy into any of that stuff anymore?
No, because I can see what this type of satire and humor is all about. But it's funny because to be in this position at times, just because of my upbringing, I do find myself a little bit wrestling with it at times. It's the sacrilegious stuff that bothers me really more than I think anything else. But it's been weird to even my dad, they both are they're just not fans.
Are you still a fairly religious guy?
No, I mean we're bad Catholics. We don't go to church. Sure. We don't, but our kids, are they're really good souls, and they're spiritual in a better way, I think, than we were as we grew up.
Yeah.
It was all didactic and
church or like the spirituality we were handed in Catholic school was like, well, it's this or there's really nothing else.
It's this guilt. Or hell.
It's all just guilt trips.
And I think a lot of a lot of my friends in high school like got really fascinated by like witchcraft books and stuff, like just trying to find something, like there's got to be something else.
I remember when I was going to Catholic school, and like it was all this like doom and gloom all the time. And then I talked to my friend who was like a Christian kid he was just like, I'm in a band, and we play these kind of rock and roll songs, and we'll have like a short service, and then we'll all go to the beach. And I'm like, that sounds so much fun. Like, yeah, it just helps us. All this togetherness helps us feel closer to God and each other. I was like, what? I have to sit for an hour and a half on a Sunday and cry because I did something wrong, I think.
Oh, yeah. Every time I'd knock one off, I thought I was going to go to hell. I go,
Still worth it.
I promise I'll never, ever do that again. And then to go through that cycle 5-6 times a day.
Oh.
When you're 13, it's just terrible. It's like, it makes you go insane.
Okay. So counting this one. Okay, tomorrow. So, but the end of this day,
And then never again.
Dear Father, forgive me for all my sins, and can we hurry this up? I got to go do it again.
And you turn it on, there's Family Ties is on, Mallory's got a cute top on, and then all of a sudden you're begging to God to forgive you. Right, guys? Right, guys? She's the hot sister.
Yeah, she's good. She's good. We're not saying she's not. Yeah.
All right, fine. It's a Teeny Others only episode. I can work with that.
Nick.
I'll make it work.
Yeah.
You do whatever it takes.
Jacqueline Smith.
Jacqueline Smith. Oh. I just read, okay, this is off topic, but it's about Bill Murray, who is always somewhere in my heart. I just read that the reason he didn't come back for Charlie's Angels 2 is because allegedly on Charlie's Angels 1, there was a weird tension between he and Lucy Liu.
I told you that story.
You told me this story.
Yeah. Where she was, he was improvising, so she started improv. And then it just kept on going, and she kept on messing up the scene.
Well, the story that I read was that the way it was retold, and who knows, you know, what version of phone book this is.
Yeah.
But he pointed to Drew Barrymore, pointed to Cameron Diaz, and he pointed to Lucy Liu, and in this order said, "I get why you're here. You are talented. I have no idea why you're here. You can't act." And then she like went at him.
Oh wow!
Like punch throwing. And they had to be separated and complete the movie on these terms.
The story I heard is that like she kept on trying to improv in a scene, and everyone was just letting her do it because she's one of the producers. And then he's like, "You know what? Just stop trying to improv." She's like, "Why? You're doing it, and you do it all the time." He's like, "I'm a comedic genius. You won the lottery." Which I want to believe. I want to believe that that's the true version.
It was such a huge, really huge bump in the road for Bill that he wasn't in Charlie Angels 2.
Yeah.
I know
he's got his fingers crossed for Charlie's Angels 3.
Yeah. Fuller throttle.
He wants to do it.
He's
likes
the really
story.
On board.
And he'll put anything else aside.
Sure. You know, he and Lucy have exchanged some emails.
Yeah. Wes Anderson's going to direct Charlie's Angels 3.
Oh my God, that would be amazing.
How did they get Bill to do Charlie's Angels 1 is my question.
How'd they get Crispin Glover to do it?
I want to. Oh my God. Wait, go with your Crispin Glover story, and because I have to process this.
I can't watch him in a whole movie. But I mean, like even in Oliver Stone's, you know, Doors picture, the most intriguing, you know, to the two really great minutes of that were Glover's cameo as Andy Warhol. Then I found myself leaning forward on the edge of my seat. Oh, I love everything that he does. A little too much, you know, an entire film. But I love when he does small. He was in a David Lynch film, and what was that movie he did? But his cameos are stunning.
Yeah, well, him and Nick Cage kind of has that same thing, too, where it's like, as an actor, they like, and like Deanna always talks about this, like, they were from a scene that like made all the decisions. They didn't like make one decision for the character, they just made every decision. And that's why their performances are so erratic and weird every time you see him. It's like he's, you're right, it gets tiring watching an entire movie like Bartleby, or what was the one where he has to go and bury his dead cat? Another weird one.
Where's the one where he goes, "I'm making sandwiches"?
it's sort of like they're like Tabasco sauce on a scene where it's like if you dump Tabasco sauce on something, it all of a sudden becomes all about Tabasco sauce, no matter what the rest of the material is.
You've seen Bad Lieutenant, right? The
Harvey Keitel movie?
No, the Nick Cage version, Port of New Orleans.
Oh, I did not see Port of New Orleans.
You got to see that. It is a true testament to that style of acting where it's like he doesn't seem like the same guy from scene to scene. Mm. It's just a completely different guy every single time.
The going back to Wes Anderson's Charlie's Angels. I feel committed to trying to figure out how to even make a sketch of that. Of just like, because it'd be like, you take the two, you know, Charlie's Angels, quick cuts, Wes Anderson, just like one long, just one static shot.
Well, the opening scene would just be like, you know, like just going over all the different character traits of the different angels, you know, and like, it's like in the way they clean their swords and guns and stuff like that, and just a very peculiar... You know.
Do. Some adorable song
plays.
Yeah.
Or some Mark Mothersbaugh thing.
That would be incredible. All right.
Make it, internet.
Okay. So two things that we're going to make based on this are, well, no, three things. Number one, Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight. Supernatural with Ewan Cranston as a movie, and Wes Anderson's Charlie's Angels. These are the two things that we have to, make.
Patrick Warburton.
Are you up for this challenge?
Wait, I thought you were in.
I am in. I'm just trying to. I'm scheduling in my mind right now. What do we want to do first?
What kind of what? I think it's interesting that the Catholic upbringing was so hammered into your head that you still can't help but feel a little, you know, even. And I'm not a religious guy, and when I hear someone say super, you know, like something super traditionally sacrilegious, there is a small molecule of me that's for a second goes like, you shouldn't say that. And then I'm like, oh yeah, I don't really care, you know, but because it was so hammered as a child.
Right. Well, it's weird, you know, because it becomes a part of you, but at the same time, I think your perception of things changes a little bit. I mean, I get satire, I get what it is, you know, but weird things pop up, and usually I just try to keep my mouth shut about stuff, you know. But there's this one instance where I was doing sort of a reporter satellite thing on the phone. So I was on the phone with like about, you know, like 8 or 9 different writers. And they're asking questions about Rules, which is this show I've been doing. We're just coming on, we're going to open up the season. And so all the shows were mostly in relation to Rules. But there was an episode of Family Guy that had been on the week before where they had a character as Sarah Palin's Down syndrome kid. And it got some heat. And so one of the reporters said, what did you think of the Family Guy, Sarah Palin kid episode of the Family Guy? Did you think that was offensive? I go, well, I guess I did, you know, because I just didn't think that one scene, I didn't think it was, you know, cool. And I probably could have just, you know, taken the fifth, but I said something. And I should know that was the only thing that would have been important that I said all day, because I'm on the show and I said something critical. So the next thing you know, it's like, it's in the Washington Post, and then I call my publicist. I go, is this anything that be concerned about? Nah, no big deal. Nobody will give a shit tomorrow. Then the next day, Bill O'Reilly. Bill O'Reilly calls me a patriot. Bill Cosby was the pinhead, and I was the patriot. Patriot for going to Sarah Palin's defense.
Oh no! Come on.
Yeah. So even now Sarah Palin's defense.
Now all of a sudden, because this is just one little blurb. I just said, I just didn't think it was funny. So then. And then I got to write up. Now I'm writing like just as a press release, you know, saying to them and to the Washington Post, saying I didn't go to Sarah Palin's defense. I go, what I found offensive was the depiction of a specific special needs child who can't. I go, Sarah Palin is an adult and a politician. She could defend herself, and she's subject to satire. But a 2-year-old special needs child is not and cannot, and that goes against the norms of satire. But I don't want to look like a hypocrite here, because I'm on a show and half the shit I do is offensive. All I'm saying is I thought that one thing wasn't funny and I don't like that.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah.
That's all. And then it goes back out. Now it's in the Washington Post. Warburton wants nothing to do with O'Reilly's head of the back. This whole thing, guys, couldn't have gotten stupider.
From one offhanded comment.
Could
then,
not have gotten stupider.
Then you get in the press release writing business.
Yeah. And then I go to work, you know, and then so it's like, this is back before Seth was the man behind the curtain. This is a few years ago. He was still usually directing most of the episodes.
Hey, Seth, what's
up? So he's not there. And he's not there. He's like in another studio in the building. You know, and I got my headphones on and I don't see him. And then I just hear this, hello, Benedict Arnold. But he was messing with me. He loves me.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad you guys were able to work it out. Yeah. Well, it's nice that you can express your opinion about, and then he doesn't take it personally.
Oh, but Seth, like, what does he care? It all helps create, you know, it's all, I think, part of the body of it all. And it makes it more interesting and intriguing anyways. He loves the idea that my mother hates the show. He's wanted to interview her, which I think could be fun. I can't throw my mom under the bus like that, though, because it's not going to look good. And, I know it'll just make her look like she's this crazy religious fanatic.
Kind of is.
I'm doing a pilot for Fox now, or for what Fox? I'm doing a pilot for CBS, which is has a character that's. She's a religious fan. My mother is a religious fan, so she's based on my mother. So,
did you create the show?
There's some of the ideas are my ideas. Yeah.
Oh, fun.
So, you know, my mom would always say, you know, this family, would make a great story. Wouldn't this would make a great TV show? And so I kind of had to go, Mom, remember what you always used to say?
Yeah. I hope you're ready to examine the show. Yeah, I hope you're ready.
My wacky religious fanatic mothers.
Keep that in mind.
Based on you.
Mom, some people find mirrors to be upsetting. In a show form. Yeah. Are you, do you play, so you, do you play a version of yourself, or do you play,
yeah, kind of, well, this guy's more of, you know, he's, like a retired pro ball player, but, it's not about that at all. It's going to be about his life, his family, his world, you know,
okay.
And that's what makes, you know, I think it'll make a show work. It makes it show work ultimately as a good ensemble cast, and so that's what we're focusing on here.
I'm glad to hear that. Any great show has a fucking awesome ensemble cast, and so many times they, you know, like sitcoms will try to build a show around one person. It's like, when
you can't do
does that ever have worked? It's always Seinfeld had, you know, a cast of characters. Cheers, Night Court, any great.
I worked on shows before, and so I will not name names, where I was told by writers, you know, unsolicited writers would come and say, I'd love to write for you. We'd love to write for you, but we can't because of so-and-so. And then I've worked with, you know, Jerry Seinfeld, who would hire, you know, Michael Richards, who's an obvious scene stealer.
Yeah.
And Michael Richards is just kills every time. I mean, well, I used to watch, remember my wife and I used to watch before I ever got the opportunity to be on that show, and you waited for him to make an appearance because it was just magic. I mean, what he did was unbelievable.
He was smart, just like Jack Benny. But so Jerry, but you knew at the end of the day, you go, hey, did you watch Seinfeld? Did you watch a Jack Benny show? Like, it makes the show better,
right? Yeah.
And it's
Jerry's
their show.
He's not, you know, he's not that non-ego for him that he's nervous about somebody stealing. You know, he wanted to make the best show he could, and he did. And so I think that's important, you know. It's important to fill those roles with people that, you know, actors that are awesome, you know.
Is there anything else you wanted to sort of to plug or throw out there before we wrap it up?
Pearl Jam, you can tell people to buy Pearl Jam albums?
I don't know. I don't know what to say right now.
All right.
You're throwing me off.
Sorry.
10, 9, 8, 7.
Are we there? I've got to pee like a racehorse, so this is good.
Standing up on all fours?
They do it while running.
I will. This is almost empty. I'll just use this.
And just make unbreaking eye contact as you're just slowly peeing into
it's getting full.
Give me another bottle.
Oh, also, I love doing a Thrilling Adventure Hour with you. Like, you're fucking great on Thrilling Adventure Hour.
Are you doing it anytime soon?
Yeah, I am doing it very soon, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, you know what you're doing? It next weekend. Right? It's the first weekend of March.
Yeah.
First through third. I can't because that is the weekend of my St. Jude Children's Research Hospital event in Palm Springs.
I'm from Memphis, St. Jude, Memphis.
Yes.
Huge.
Greatest hospital in the world. If anybody, I'm so glad we're talking about this right now. Come out to Palm Springs, whoever can make it, because on Friday night the 1st, we had this jam session with Alice Cooper, Robbie Krieger, Don Felder, Mike Mills from REM. We got all these guys, and they jam, and you're literally standing 5 feet, 10 feet away from them because we just all come, and we've got just a bunch more. And, you know, tickets are like $100-$125 for the night. And it's just this awesome jam session. All the money goes to St. Jude.
St. Jude's is great.
St. Jude's is the greatest hospital in the world. You know, they have a lot of people. It costs $1.7 million a day for that hospital to operate.
Jeez.
You know, and they make their own medicine there because the pharmaceutical companies, and we all know, there's a corruption that lies within, and it's just innate. They don't make these medicines because it's too expensive for them. They don't make enough money. Childhood catastrophic disease is too rare, so it's not profitable for the big companies to make these medicines. So they make their own medicine on site. And they have pioneered the therapies and cures throughout the years. You know, I mean, the mortality rate for leukemia and certain childhood cancers used to be 94 to 96%, and it's now 4%. And it's primarily due to St. Jude and what they've done. I mean, if they have problems elsewhere in the world, like horrible things, they go to St. Jude for answers. So
You can just donate to St. Jude.
You can just donate to St. Jude. But if you want to have a lot of fun, come out to this event and do it. And, you know, we got a big dinner and comedy night on Saturday night. Kevin Pollak's going to do the
awesome. Great.
And my buddy Mike Wilson and Rachel Butera are going to do a show before them. Rachel, you know, from the Stern Show.
Yeah.
So Mike and Rachel are literally going to go in a 15 to 20 minute period, the history of TV and film. doing characters from everything in a progressive world. Like,
that sounds fun.
It's going to be awesome.
That's awesome. Well,
and a guy from REM playing with Alice Cooper. That's just something that I mean,
that too.
That's like when
this
you
is
seen...
his first. Yeah, because he's a golfer, so he's going to play, but he hasn't been doing this stuff before. So this is his advent into doing the celebrity golf tournament rock jam session.
That's fun.
Stuff. He's going to just come out and play with us. Yeah,
it was so nice to have you on the program, Patrick Warburton. I hope we get to do something else fun together at some point.
Well, let's do this next week. I'll be back
every week. Yeah, but you're going to be recording anyway. You might as well just fucking come across the street and tell
That's
us.
Right.
Give us some Family
Guy. Talk about stamps and coins and Pearl
Jam. We'll talk about stamps, coins, Pearl Jam. You can give us some Family Guy spoilers.
There you go.
And give us mom updates.
Sweet.
All right, Patrick Warburton, thank you for being here. Will you? I feel like we tell people to enjoy. We tell people at the end of the episode, we say enjoy your burrito. I feel like it'll sound a lot better coming from you because you have a better voice than I do.
No, it's different.
It's better, different, better.
Differently
enjoy
better.
Your burrito.
Fucking see? No question that's better. It's different because mine's inferior.
That tickle your ears in there, in those cans?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It tickled my ear cans. I'm Marino, man.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Squarespace.com. Now with commerce solutions, so you can start selling stuff on your high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to Squarespace.com/Nerdist and use the offer code Nerdist3.